This next section is called Samana. And that starts off with a quotation from the Majjhima Nikaya, Sutta number 40. Samanas, Samanas, that is how people perceive you. And when asked, what are you? You claim that we are Samanas. So, with this being your designation and this your claim, you should think, we will practice the way of the Samana with integrity, so that our designations will be true and our claims accurate, so that the services of those whose robes, arms, food, lodging, and medicinal requisites we use will bring them great fruit and benefit, so that our going forth will not be barren, but fruitful and fertile. Thus, monks, should you train yourselves. The word Samana, usually translated as recluse or contemplative, is generally taken to be derived from a word meaning ascetic striving. And Paul preferred to render it as, quote, one whose mind is at peace, unquote. At the time of the Buddha, it was the name given to members of the various religious sects who had abandoned their caste identity and the life of the householder. In the Buddhist tradition, Samana has been used as a synonym for both monk and true monk. In the sutta passage above, the Buddha refers to its first meaning as a conventional designation and urges monks to constantly bear in mind their responsibilities to act in conformity with it. As true monk, quote-unquote, the word samana encompasses all the qualities that monks should aspire to. Lumpur encouraged monks to dwell upon and consciously cultivate the perception of themselves as monks or samanas by constantly reminding themselves of their role and responsibilities and the goals of their monastic life. By doing so, he wanted them to cultivate a new identity as a skillful means, not an ultimate truth, that would distance them from their former identities in the world and serve to strengthen the mental factors of wise shame and fear of consequences. This perception was to give them a wholesome sense of pride in their lineage and of being upholders of an ancient tradition. It was meant to inspire them with the guiding ideals of Sangha life. So these terms, wise shame and fear of consequences, that's hiri otapa, which is a pair of terms very much used in the Buddha's teachings, and they are, speaking of the qualities of the heart that guide our behavior towards what is wholesome. So there's different ways that they are defined. So the word shame usually has a negative connotation, or sometimes guilt is even worse. But it's that, the feeling in the heart of regret or sadness or discomfort when something unwholesome, you know, unskillful is done. So that if you're telling a lie or you deliberately harm another creature, that sense of hiri is that recognition of the painful quality of that action. So it's what you can call a moral sensitivity, So that it's a quality that is taken as not as a sort of neurotic problem, that is something that you don't want to feel shame or you don't want to feel bad, but rather it's reflecting a nobility, a respect for the lives and property and feelings of others. And then otapa, here he renders as a fear of consequences, so recognizing that any kind of unskillful action, any kind of unwholesome words, unkindness, there's going to be consequences. And so that if the intention is unskillful, is unwholesome, then there'll be painful consequences to that action. The another way that those two are rendered is hiri is sometimes referred to as the sensitivity to your own actions, your own speech, and the feeling of regret or painfulness, mental painfulness that is there when we behave in an unskillful, in a greedy or unkind, unwholesome way. And then otapa, sometimes it's talked about the impact that seeing others behaving in that way, so that it's seeing people behaving in a way that is violent or dishonest or foolish, then that withdrawing or that recoiling, that sense of drawing away from unwholesomeness, not in a negative or a destructive way, but just that sense of I don't want to be near that. I'm not interested in being around that. I don't want to be around people who are violent or indulgent or doing crazy things to themselves or other people. So it's some suttas, the Buddha uses the image of a sinew, an animal from an animal's muscle, a sinew dropped onto a fire, and the sinew will naturally coil up and withdraw from the flame. It retreats from the heat of the flame. And he uses that as an image to describe that sense of recoiling or withdrawing, retreating from the unwholesome. So that is something that is painful or unpleasant to the heart. Also part of this as a samana and in a sense of a new identity, one of the obvious ways that works is getting a new name. So when you become a silatara or you become a samanera, then you get given a Dhamma name. Or as a layperson, you can request for a Dhamma name from an elder. And it's a way of revisioning who and what you are, you literally change your name. You change your way of referring to this being, this life, this activity in the world. And so that then by taking on a different name or being given a different name, it's a way of letting go of the identity that was given to you by your parents or by society and the worldly associations, the worldly values that go along with that, and putting that aside, then taking a new name to revision this life and this quality of being, or this center of experience that we call being alive or being a human being. A samana's life was characterized by the sincere effort to study and practice the threefold training of sila, samadhi, and panya in order to realize liberation and to inspire others by their conduct. And this is Lumpo Cha speaking. Firstly, resolve to have victory over yourself. That's the main thing. You don't need victory over anything or anyone else. If you're always thinking of defeating other people, you're losing the battle of practice. True practice is based on reaching the point where you know how to achieve a constant victory over yourself. Ultimately, if you achieve a victory over yourself, then you achieve a victory over all things. Establish this principle constantly in your mind. And also there's a verse in the Dhammapada in the section called the Thousands, I believe, the Sasata Vagga, the Thousands, and the Buddha says it's easier to conquer an army of 1,000 people 1,000 times over single-handedly than it is to conquer yourself. So just in case anyone was wondering why it's so difficult, that's 1,000,000 people. So 1,000 times 1,000 is 1,000,000. So single-handed to defeat 1,000,000 people is easier than to defeat yourself. In a memoir, Ajahn Khemadamo summarized, "And the purpose of our life, we were never allowed to forget. We are monks, not for gain and fame, not for status and worldly advancement, but in order that we may have the best possible chance of facing our defilements. All those spoiling influences in our hearts and minds, seeing and understanding them and casting them out to achieve a secure and lasting peace, the real happiness of Nibbana." In one discourse, Lumpo challenged the monks. "What do you want? Wealth and respect? Rank and honors? Material things? We're monastics. The Buddha taught us not to aim at such things. If you're intent on pleasure, on fun, on an easy life and good food, or material things, then it would be better if you hadn't become a monk at all. It means you're lying and deceiving the lay people. If you want all that, then go out and make a living as a layperson. There's no point in coming to live here in the forest, going without sleep and eating only once a day. Reflect on this deeply. Ask yourself the question, what did I come here for? What am I doing here? You've shaved off your hair, put on the ochre robe. What for? Go ahead, ask yourself. Do you think it's just to eat and sleep and live a heedless life? If that's what you want, you can do that in the world. Take the oxen and buffalo out to the fields, come back home, eat and sleep. Anyone can do that. If you come and act in that neglectful, indulgent way in the monastery, then you're not worthy of the name of monks and novices. Life as a monk offered great opportunities for cultivation of the path, but without the willingness to overcome old habits, it was easy to founder, to get lost, or to lose your way. Again, Lumbhacharya speaking. If you accept the basic principles and try to follow them, you'll have a practice. But if you don't accept them and just follow your likes and dislikes, you'll be heading for disaster. Even if you live as a monk for 20 or 30 years, you still won't know the flavor of the Buddha's teachings. You'll be like the fisherman who goes every day to fish in a pond without any fish in it. However diligent such a fisherman might be, he's always disappointed. Day after day, he casts his net and brings in nothing. Recollection of the great masters could bring the mind back onto the right track when it wandered. Their attainments could be emulated through the power of wise effort. Again, Lumbhacharya speaking. Read the biographies of the great teachers. They're singular people, aren't they? They're different. Think carefully about that difference. Train your mind in the correct way. You don't have to depend on anyone else. Discover your own skillful means to train your mind. If the more skillful means were unable to stem the flow of deluding thought, then a more direct approach was needed. Whatever did the job. Once the immediate danger had been averted, a more nuanced approach could be returned to. If the mind starts thinking of worldly things, then quickly subdue it. Stop it. Get up. Change your posture. Tell yourself not to think about such things. There are better things to think about. It's essential that you don't just mildly yield to those thoughts. Once they've gone from your mind, then you'll feel better. Don't imagine that you can take it easy and your practice will take care of itself. Everything depends on training. Any particular questions, thoughts, reflections on that?
Yes. Wondering about the apart from the sutta, the very beginning, that notion that the gifts to those who have practiced well are very fruitful, and the Buddha used that multiple times to try to motivate his monks.
Mm-hmm.
But it's one of the stranger aspects of karma that. You know, it doesn't. I could use a better understanding of it if such a thing is, you know, possible or available. It seems second nature to many Asians, but I think it's not remarkable. It doesn't ring with our culture very well.
What do you mean? What the fruits of their practice are?
Or? Well, the idea that if you that a donor who gives to a realized being,
mm-hmm.
even if the donor doesn't know that the being, you know, that this
uh-huh.
is a realized monk, it's a lot better than, you know, just a, you know, ordinary monk or, you know, even worse, one who isn't practicing well.
Mm-hmm.
And that seems fairly clear from the suttas, but it's a point I can't get my mind around.
A couple of suttas in the Majjhima Nikaya, one's called the Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, the exposition of offerings, And there's also the Mahakama and the Chulakama Vibhanga Sutta there. They're also there in the Majjhima Nikaya. So in that Dakina Vibhanga Sutta, the exposition of offerings, then the Buddha talks about giving and saying how it's more meritorious to give to someone who keeps the precepts and who doesn't keep the precepts, and even more meritorious is to give to someone who's a stream enterer, and then more to a once returner, a non-returner, to an arahant. But it's and then more meritorious to give to a sangha than to give to an arahant. So even it's more meritorious to give to a sangha of unenlightened beings, where there's not even a single stream enterer in the whole group, than it is to give to an arahant, which is kind of interesting. And then also makes a point of saying it's also meritorious in terms of giving it, that yes, you can think of it in those terms. But he said even if you have washed your alms bowl and you pour away the dirty water from your bowl onto the ground, and you have the thought may living beings benefit from the food scraps that are here in the bowl washing water. That even that is meritorious and shouldn't be ignored. That there's blessings and benefit that come from that. So I mean, there's different ways of regarding it, and without trying to feed superstitions, but the principle is rather like where you plant your seeds. You know, if the ground is fertile, and you know the soil is good, and the ground is moist, and if you put the seed into good soil, then it will likely grow up and succeed as a plant. And if it's got enough moisture, enough sunlight, and so forth, if you put the seed into dry soil or poor soil, then it's going to struggle to flourish. And so that in terms of the karmic effects of supporting the life of someone who is very virtuous, someone who is who's realized certain degrees of liberation, that's fertile soil. So that's like in the chanting that we do, they give occasion for incomparable goodness to arise in the world. That's a loose rendering of the term punya keta, which is a field of blessings or a field of merit. So the sangha, as I said, it's more meritorious to give to a sangha than it is to give to an arahant, or even to the Buddha. It's more meritorious to give to a sangha than to an individual monastic, even if they're fully enlightened, because the principle of giving without preference for a particular individual to support the sangha as a whole, that's the intention. That is, insofar as those things can be calculated, then it's kind of more meritorious. Because it's more fertile ground, you're supporting the sangha as a whole. It's also why in Lumpur Cha's monasteries, people, if they wanted to invite certain, they wanted to say, I want this monk, and this monk to come to my house, Lumpur Cha would say, no, there'll be five members of the sangha will come. That's it. You can't choose. So he wouldn't let people accept personal invitations, on the basis that it's more skillful to invite the sangha rather than your favorite, whoever your favorite people are, the ones that you're kind of, because you're not connecting with them on that worldly level, but rather it's just the sangha that you're supporting. So that's the essential principle, but it's also in another sutta called the Velama Sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya, the numerical discourses, where the Buddha goes through this whole long list of it's more meritorious to give to a stream enterer than a worldling, or it's more virtuous to give to a human being than to an animal, or to a virtuous human being than a non-virtuous human being, to a stream enterer, and so on, through the whole scale up to it's more virtuous, or there's more blessings that come from giving to a sangha with a Buddha at the head. And then he goes on to say, but it's even more meritorious to keep the five precepts yourself. That keep the five precepts is more meritorious than any kind of material offering. And then to practice loving kindness for the time it takes to milk a cow is even more meritorious than keeping the five precepts. And then finally, at the very end of the sutta, he says, but even more meritorious than that is to sustain the insight into anicca for a finger snap. So that it's a the quality of blessings or merit that comes from an offering or an action to a certain degree is depending on who it's made to, but there's also the intention behind it, and then there's also the training of your own heart, so that he puts the keeping of the precepts or cultivating loving kindness or development of insight above any kind of good karma that arises from a material donation. There's another sutta, a different one, where he talks about the purification through offerings, and he says that an offering can be purified by the donor, by the recipient, by both the donor and by the recipient, or neither by the donor nor by the recipient. And so that it can be an unvirtuous person gives an offering to a virtuous person, or a virtuous person gives an offering to an unvirtuous person, an unvirtuous person gives an offering to an unvirtuous person, or a virtuous person gives an offering to a virtuous person. He said, of those four, then the one where a virtuous person makes an offering to another virtuous person, that brings the greatest karmic benefits. Again, it's to do with sort of the quality of fertile ground, and that the quality of punya or blessings, or really the brightness of heart, is the quality that's being generated. And so that if you have a wholesome intention, so that the gift is purified by the donor. So even if it's an offering made to an unskillful person, to an unenlightened, unvirtuous person, but the person who's making the offering has a very good intention and is very virtuous, then it brings a lot of merit with it, even if the person is the recipient or is not virtuous at all. I'm not sure if that makes things clearer or not, but it's to do with the in a sense that it's like a moral universe, if you like. That the laws of the universe involve that there's qualities of morality and the impact of wholesome and unwholesome actions. So it's like those qualities of Hiri and Otapa, they are an aspect of that moral universe, or the innate morality or the moral laws of the universe. And so that it's kind of interesting that with Hiri Otapa, the moral sensitivity, the more enlightened somebody is, then the more difficult it is for them to do anything unskillful. And there's another sutta in the Anguttara Nikaya. Well, it's two suttas actually, side by side in the Anguttara, where the Buddha says talks about what it's impossible for an arahant to do. So that an arahant cannot deliberately take the life of a living being. Like it's impossible. It can't happen. An arahant can't deliberately take the life of another living being. An arahant can't steal. It's impossible. They cannot steal. They are naturally celibate. An arahant can't engage intentionally in sexual intercourse. It's impossible that. And they cannot tell a lie. The tongue cannot form the words of a lie. So that it's like the natural disposition of the enlightened mind is that it's impossible for them to break at least the first four of the five precepts. And it's very interesting that the fifth one, rather than being about not consuming intoxicants, it's about an arahant can't deliberately lay up a store of things. They can't, they can't keep a bit extra for later, or keep something for tomorrow. An arahant cannot deliberately store things up, which is an interesting reflection. worthy of consideration, so that if you, so yeah, you know, it's interesting. It crosses my mind when I also, you know, as a senior monk, you get your attendants tend to fill your cupboard with extra tubes of toothpaste and such like. But I make a point of never having extra stuff myself most of the time. Generally, I think that's true. That on that basis of not trying to claim to be an arahant, but just don't lay up a store for tomorrow. You don't have to think about next week or next year. That there are other tubes of toothpaste in the world. You don't have to get an extra one for yourself. Just live with what you've got for now, and then tomorrow, let the things of the morrow take care of themselves, as it says. So that it becomes the more enlightened someone becomes, the more difficult it is to be immoral. The more it's like a natural law. So that when talking about somebody who's spiritually mature, then they'll say they have a lot of hiryotapa. They have a great deal of moral sensitivity. It gets stronger rather than being I'm totally liberated, therefore I don't care about anything. But rather, the more the heart is liberated, the more incapable it is of moving towards anything unskillful or deceitful or that's harmful or dishonest. Any other thoughts, questions?
Is there yes. a certain recipe, if you commit a certain amount of unwholesome acts, then it equals a certain amount of dana or a certain amount of wholesome acts?
15 Hail Marys will get you off. Well, there's a lot of... A lot of monasteries have been built. A lot of schools and monasteries and hospitals and places have been built, trying to basically as fire insurance. You know, trying to offset the unskillful activities. The Buddha points out that the karma and vipaka, action and its results, so they have it's a natural law, so that you can good action and unskillful action, it's not like an easy equation. Those things can't cancel each other out necessarily, but sometimes if someone is a commits a particularly unskillful act, if it's just one unskillful thing that they've done in a lifetime of incredible virtue and positivity, then that'll still have an effect, but that the impact of that unwholesome or that unskillful act will be diminished. But there'll be a result, but it might have a very heavily buffered effect. Similarly, if someone lives a very unskillful life and they do one good thing, and then still that good thing that they've done is going to have a positive effect, and that that even in that they're creating a lot of confusion or darkness, then that'll be something that's beneficial. So there's an interesting dialogue in the Buddhist world as well as in the West. There's a strong mythology about the last moment of your life having an impact on where you're going to be reborn, or what happens to you in your next life. But that's not really substantiated by the Pali Canon. That's more Buddhist folk belief that came along from the commentaries and superstition. There's a dialogue between the Buddha and Mahanama, who was a cousin or a relative of his. And so Mahanama was the ruler of the Sakyans. You know, the Buddha had given up the throne but it was a member of his family. Mahanama was a good sort of dedicated disciple and been devoted to the Buddha for a long time. And so Mahanama went to the Buddha and said, you know, I'm really worried because, you know, I'm the head of state, and so my mind is filled with all of this sort of worldly nonsense about running the country and worrying about the economy and running the army and the concern about security and so on and so forth. So I'm really worried that if I'm going along the street and I fall off my horse or I get hit by a runaway elephant or or I just, you know, fall down and die in the street, I'm gonna die with my head filled with all of this worldly nonsense. And so I'm really concerned what the effect of that is, because I'm just, you know, going along with the duties of a ruler. There's all of this thinking and worrying and planning and responsibilities, this whole list of stuff that I've got to look after. And so the Buddha said, well, do not be afraid, Mahanama, do not be afraid, because for many years, for many decades, you have had great faith in the Triple Gem, and you've taken refuge in the Buddha, the Dhamma, the Sangha, and so that will have its beneficial effect. He said, just as if you take an earthenware pot filled with ghee and you immerse it into a bowl of water and you break the pot, the shards of clay, the earthenware, will fall to the bottom of the dish, and the ghee will rise to the surface. He said, in the same way, at the breaking up of the body, because you've lived with great faith and great commitment and dedication for all these years, then your body will break up and return to the elements, but your mind will rise to distinction. Do not be afraid, Mahanama, do not be afraid. So in the specific occasion when the Buddha is asked about that, he says the last moment doesn't matter that much, but rather it's what you've been doing for the previous 40 years. That's what really matters. So as I was saying, things, and it's not an easy equation, things don't always balance each other out tit for tat, but sometimes people who are very, very virtuous, like the Buddha himself, that in the stories there's an account of him having a headache for 3 days, and when his doctor Jivaka and Ananda are trying to find kinds of medicine to help treat him and make the headache go away, then he said don't be concerned, there's nothing you can do about this. He said, in a previous existence I was a boy and I caught a fish in a pond outside the village. And when I caught the fish, I knocked its head on the rock 3 times to kill the fish. So this headache is going to be here for 3 days. So there's nothing you can do. There's no medicine that you can give me. And so even the Buddha, that he was still able to be the recipient of the results of unskillful action. That's one of the Buddhist legends. I don't think that's actually in the canon. It might be. I'm not sure. Any canonical scholars here? But anyway, there are similar instances, like with Angulimala, when the Buddha, when Angulimala was a mass murderer, and when he became a monk, he also became an arahant eventually. But he would, in the Angulimala Sutra, it describes how he would go out. He came back from alms round one day, and his head was bleeding from injuries, and his robe was torn, his bowl was broken, and it seems to have been either people throwing rocks at him, you know, the families of the people he killed, and revenging themselves on him, but also it's not particularly clear, but it seems like it was, you know, tiles would fall off roofs, or branches would just drop out of a tree as he's walking underneath, and he'd get, you know, conked on the head by a falling branch. And so, anyway, the Buddha says to him, bear it, Angulimala, bear it, you know, be patient, because you're experiencing the results now of actions that would have seen you suffering in the lower realms for many thousands of years, many hundreds of thousands of years. So, because he's an arahant, he gets a sort of a mild version, or the bad karma, the bad karmic effects are diluted. And the Buddha is saying that you can't escape the negative results of your actions completely, but it's heavily reduced, it's diminished because of the great wholesomeness that you've generated with your life, and the state of your mind has buffered the effects of the unskillful action. That makes sense? There's also another interesting description the Buddha says, where if you take a spoonful of salt and you put it into a glass of water, then it tastes very, very salty. If you take a spoonful of salt and you put it into the Ganges River and you drink the water from the river, you can't taste the salt. So similarly, someone who has lived an unskillful life, who doesn't have much merit and virtue, if they do something unskillful, then there's a strong effect from that. Like you just put the salt into a glass and it tastes really salty. But if someone who's lived a very wholesome life, who's generally very, very well behaved and has many noble qualities, if they do something unskillful, then it's like, yeah, it's still unskillful, but the effects of that are greatly diminished, like the salt going into a river. You know, there's so much water, it's so heavily diluted, you can't possibly taste the salt. So that it's an image that he uses to describe the different results from similar actions. But also, the workings of karma are one of the four imponderables, the achinteya, so that there's the ultimate beginning of things, the range of the mind of a Buddha, all of the levels of meditative concentration and the workings of karma. These are the four imponderables that you can't, no amount of thinking will enable you to figure it out. So that it's impossible to fully understand or comprehend all of the workings of karma. Whether that's encouraging or depressing, I don't know, but it's another of the teachings about that. So there's always going to be a mysterious quality to it, or not being able to see how things fit together. And also there's a... one of the questions that's asked of the Buddha in that it's either the Maha Kamavibhanga Sutta, either the greater or the lesser discourse on action in the Majjhima Nikaya, and so the question is, well, why do you know this is a person who lives unskillfully? How come they seem to be enjoying their life and having a good time, and they don't seem to be reaping the results of their bad actions? And how come this good person, very kind, very virtuous, very noble, and they seem to have a really miserable life? People have been asking that question, you know, all over the world for many, many centuries. And the Buddha's description is, well, his account of that is saying, well, it can be that a person has done some kind of unskillful action a long time ago in a previous lifetime, and so that even though this lifetime they've been very virtuous and noble and kind and good, then the painful results of that previous action just happens to be ripening in this lifetime. Similarly, the people who are living unskillfully, it might be that they are definitely creating bad karma, but that bad karma isn't ripening. It will ripen in the future to some degree, but it just hasn't ripened yet, and they're still able to enjoy the benefits of previous good actions. So they're able to ride on the credit of their past good actions, and that's seeing them through. But the results of their current unskillful actions have yet to ripen. But it's good not to be too mechanistic about it, or keep a score sheet or anything. The most helpful thing is also to recognize that a lot of what happens in our life is just because we were born. It's not because of good karma or bad karma. It's just birth brings with it different events, different experiences. And so we can read too much. We can get too superstitious about the things that happen around us and within us. And say, oh, why did that happen to me? So people come and talk to me almost every day, ask these kind of questions. Well, why did this happen to me? And usually I'm singularly unsympathetic, and I say, well, because you're born. Yes, it's not anything special. It's just the fact that you're born. You have a body. You have a mind. Stuff happens. The vipaka, the resultant karma of having a life, means that you're going to get ill sometimes, or how could you possibly be the one person that never gets ill, everybody likes, and only ever has good luck? It's, you know, why would you be singled out to be that one person that never has anything painful or difficult in your life? It's highly unlikely. So it's not It's not often what people want to hear, but I feel it's most accurate and helpful advice. Okay, to continue, the next section is called The Marvel of Instruction, and the subtitle, Modes of Teaching. The body of Lungpo Cha's teachings is generally considered to consist of the material recorded on reel-to-reel tapes and audio cassettes and then transcribed and printed in books, originally in Thai and subsequently translated into many other languages. But for his monastic disciples, the formal discourses captured by those audio recordings and reproduced in books were only one part, and perhaps not the most important part, of what they received from him. Lumpur's most powerful teaching for those who lived with him was, arguably, not what he said or even what he did, but who he was and who he was perceived to be. His disciples saw him as the living, visible proof that there was truly an end to suffering and that it could be achieved through practice of the Noble Eightfold Path. Seeing him, sensing him nearby, gave them the strength of mind to endure the difficulties of the training. In the beginning, it was often faith in the teacher himself, rather than in specific, profound teachings he imparted, that kept young monks in the robes. Charisma is not an inevitable fruit of liberation. Some fully enlightened beings prefer a life of obscurity and project a quiet and unobtrusive air that makes them almost invisible. Lumpur was not such a figure. He was, in all meanings of the word, an impressive monk. His presence impressed itself effortlessly upon those around him. One Western monk said of him, "If any human being deserves to be called a force of nature, quote-unquote, it's Lumpur." The Buddha referred to the teacher as the Kalyanamitta, or good friend. He was not a guru to be worshipped, but a wise and compassionate guide on the path. He inspired strong confidence through his impeccable practice of the Vinaya and the monastic observances. He practiced what he preached and did not ask his disciples to do anything that he would not do himself. He taught monks to spend every spare moment on the walking meditation path, and he would often be seen pacing up and down on his own path. The sense of solidity and unwavering purpose in the way he lived his life transmitted itself to his disciples. The feelings of faith, love and devotion, respect and reverence that Lumpur inspired in those around him provided the emotional context in which his oral teachings were received and played an important part in the effect they produced. Teaching ability is as little an inevitable outcome of liberation as charisma. Inarticulate unenlightened monks usually become inarticulate enlightened monks. Lumpur, however, had always been a fine and fluent speaker. As a Kalyanamitta to a large group of monks and lay supporters, his ability to transmit the teachings in a clear and rousing manner appropriate to his audience became renowned. So that's one of those masterful phrases of Ajahn Jayasaro's. Inarticulate, unenlightened monks usually became inarticulate, enlightened monks. Not that the enlightenment is guaranteed. But sometimes people assume that with liberation, with enlightenment, there is someone becomes automatically a gifted speaker. But the teacher of Venerable Ajahn Mun, Ajahn Sao, himself was famously inarticulate, and that gave very, very brief Dhamma talks. One that I was told. When I was staying at a forest monastery, Lumpur Tui's monastery, one of the monks there told me that Ajahn Sao was famous on the observance day. He was asked to give a Dhamma talk. He got up onto the Dhamma seat and recited the Namo Tassa and then said, "Being good is good. Ewang." That was it, that was the talk. It's good to be good. What else is there to say? He also was, there's these accounts of him with Ajahn Mun, when Ajahn Mun was his student, and he was just amazed that Ajahn Mun was very articulate and kind of knowledgeable and very eloquent. And so his teacher, Ajahn Sah, was like, wow, how have you got so much to say? Like, it's extraordinary. He just couldn't put himself into his student's shoes of being so so fluent with words. And when he was a youngster, a teenager, Ajahn Mun had been very gifted at the what they call the Morlam, or the spontaneous folk songs that they have in northeast Thailand. They have these kind of singing competitions, and so that the Morlam is a duel. So you have two singers, and they have to make up the words of the song as they go along. They have a band playing the music, and then each of the two singers, they have to come up with a spontaneous verse. And then the next they finish their last line, and then the person has to carry on without missing a beat and come up with a rhyming verse that matches the one that the first person has come up with. And they go back and forth and back and forth till someone can't come up with a rhyme, and they fail. They're the loser. So that spontaneous versifying was something that the young Ajahn Mun, as a teenager, was very gifted at. So that was not Ajahn Sao's territory at all. It was he was very inarticulate, but that didn't stop him being an enlightened master. Ajahn Jan, a fine Dhamma teacher in his own right, found the talks so gripping he could enthuse about them half a lifetime after his first exposure. So this is Ajahn Jan speaking. Lumpur gave talks almost every day. If someone had misbehaved, then the talk might go on for hours. His voice was loud, resonant, very powerful. You felt how determined he was that his listeners should understand. It was as if he wanted his words to wear down his disciples' defilements until they were as smooth as a drum skin. His talks were on many different levels. He would talk in one way to the Sangha when there were no lay people present, and another way when they were. And another way, if he was addressing the lay people directly. He would tell us off, but not angrily. He never ran out of words. The talks were incredibly forthright and bold. He wasn't afraid of anyone. Listening to him talk, you were never bored. You were enthralled. And what he said hit home so well that even to this day, his words are still ringing in my ears. As monks walked out of the Dhamma hall after one of Lumpur's talks, it was rare not to hear voices exclaiming that parts of the talk were specifically aimed at them. How marvellous it was that Lumpur should have chosen to speak on the very subject that was currently obsessing them. Monks would speak of labouring for some time over a doubt, and then how the talk addressed that problem directly and in detail, putting their mind to rest. Ajahn Anaik said, "His words pierced to your heart. Most people's doubts about meditation would be answered during his formal talks. He would deal with exactly the problem that was frustrating you, no matter how subtle it might be. If you listened closely to every word he said, you'd find it exactly right for you. That was his genius. It was truly profound." In some cases, perhaps the majority of them, the belief monks held that Lumpur was talking to them personally may be put down to the flowing, unstructured nature of his discourses. The number of defilements is finite, and in a long talk, it's unlikely that any one of the major ones will go unmentioned, at least in passing. Indeed, Lumpur sometimes referred to casting his net, quote-unquote, with more general observations about mental defilements that hauled in all those who were affected by them. However, there were also occasions where monks were particularly moved by passages in talks that took an unexpected deviation from the flow of his discourse. Beyond dispute was the way in which the formal Dhamma talks set the tone in the monastery. In the days following a particularly inspiring talk, there would be a tangible buoyancy in the air. In the days after an admonitory exhortation, even the colours of the forest could seem subdued. So an admonitory exhortation means being scolded. Then even the colours in the forest would be subdued or dimmed. Lumpur would spend time every day, longer as he got older and less active, sitting on a wide wicker seat underneath his kuti, making himself available for anyone who wished to speak to him. During the day, most of Lumpur's conversations were with lay visitors, but monks and novices, acting as attendants, would enjoy the opportunity to listen to him, answering his guests' questions and offer reflections. Monks with free time would often sit down in a corner and listen. Sometimes Lumpur would shoo them away. No need to sit around here. Go away and meditate. At other times, he would permit them to stay. In the evenings, after the group chanting and meditation had ended, a number of monks would gravitate to Lumpur's kuti in order to listen and learn, and sometimes just to sit quietly with their eyes closed in meditation. On one occasion, a Western monk was sitting listening to Lumpur answering questions with short, succinct answers, concise but profound. And after the guests had left, he exclaimed, "Lumpur, that was just like Zen." And Lumpur replied, "No, it wasn't. It was just like me." Not all of Lumpur's teachings have been preserved. Occasionally, he would speak privately with monks whose meditation practice had reached an advanced level. The advice given during those conversations has never been revealed. It's worth bearing in mind that the Dhamma talks that have been recorded and transcribed, for all their richness, are restricted to Lumpur's public teachings. Although Lumpur was always available to disciples struggling with doubts about practice, he did not necessarily answer the questions he received, or, if he did, not in the way that they expected. He was not interested in spoon-feeding the Dhamma. Sometimes, sensing that no answer that he might give would serve any useful purpose, that it would simply increase the questioner's confusion or conceit, he would refuse to answer at all. This was not always to the questioner's liking. Lumpur would shrug. This is again Lumpur Cha speaking. If they had even a glimmering of understanding, they wouldn't ask such stupid questions in the first place. He continued, "The more you explain, the more doubts you'll create in their minds, because they haven't practiced to a point where they can understand. If they practice, then they'll know for themselves and be free of doubts." Inexperienced meditators were like small children who did not, as yet, understand the world around them. And Lumpur is speaking here. When a child sees a chicken, he asks, "Dad, Dad, what's that?" When he sees a duck, it's, "Dad, Dad, what's that?" Then he sees a pig, and again it's, "Dad, Dad, what's that?" Eventually, the father can't be bothered to answer. There's no end to the questions, because to the child, everything is new. In the end, the father just replies, If he were to answer every single question, he'd die of exhaustion. The child isn't tired at all. It never stops asking. Eventually, the problem disappears by itself as the child gets older and more experienced. In the same way, if you're devoted to reflection and persevere until you comprehend the way things are, then problems will gradually clear up by themselves. So this is very true about Lumpur. I couldn't understand Thai very well at all, if at all, in those days. But to the degree that I could, and often if you were there with him, one of the Westerners would be helping to translate, or sort of leaning over and sort of whispering the translation in your ear. And it seemed that it was almost never the case that Lumpur gave a straight answer to a question. He would never seem to just accept a question on its own terms, but rather he would, in a way, answer the person or address the place where the question came from. And he had this strange ability to, so somebody would say something, they'd ask a question, and he'd take the question and sort of take it to pieces, reassemble it, and hand it back to the questioner, and then they would then be answering the question with what he handed back to them. They would answer the question themselves, if you can follow that. So it's almost like he would get people to answer their own questions, often by rephrasing the issue or asking, you know, why are you asking me that question, or such like, and so that he was very, very adept at that. And so it was my own habit is to almost always answer a question in exactly the terms the person has asked the question, and I've been doing this for 40 years and I still can't quite break the habit. that having seen Lumpur Cha doing that, how he was completely unlimited or unbothered or unconfined by the person's attitude or their assumptions, and he could seem to see the whole picture much, much more clearly. And my own tendency would always be to just pick up the question with exactly the assumptions that the person had and answer the question in the person's own terms. Doesn't always help, very rarely helps. But when Lumpur, I don't know if Ajahn Jayasaro mentions this later on, but when somebody asked Lumpur how it was that whenever he did that, people would ask a question, he would somehow take it to pieces and hand the pieces back to them, and then they would answer their own question. He said, "Well, how is it the case that people always seem to be able to answer their own questions? How do you do that? Because they come with a doubt or they come with a problem and they don't know what to do, but somehow you help them to solve their own questions, solve their own doubts, answer their own questions." And he made the comment, if they didn't already know the answer, they wouldn't be able to ask the question in the first place. So that you just help them to go back to where the question came from, and that's where they find the answer. That makes sense? So it's a kind of, how does that work? But that principle, and I heard him say that several times over, if they didn't already know the answer, they couldn't ask the question in the first place. So you think you've got a question, you think you've got a doubt, and so, his point was, not really. You're just being lazy, or you're just looking at things in a superficial way. If you really go to the root of where the question came from, you'll actually find that you understand the issue a lot better than you realize that you do. And that, and so it was an extraordinary skill he had of reading people. He was very, very skilled at he was not just a judge of personality, but reading where people came from, reading what their attitudes were, reading their body language and the kind of disposition, the things that were on somebody's mind. And he would say that he wasn't psychic, he wasn't reading people's minds, because sometimes that people would feel it was quite eerie how accurate his comments were, or how able he was to help somebody to answer their own question. And they said, well, this is some kind of psychic trick that you're doing, or some kind of, you can read their minds. And he would say, no, it's that anything that you need to know about a person, you can tell from just the way they walk across the central area of the monastery, or the way they come into the kuti and kneel down and pay respects. Just kind of watch. You can see from their body language, or the way they sit, or the way they speak, or the way they phrase a question. Just all of that is telling you all kinds of stuff. It's like a sort of DNA profile. He could read the whole situation much more completely than an average person. So simply really, really being observant. Well, there's a lot more on this whole area of questions and explanations, so I'll leave it there for today. An hour has gone by already.